I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Today, US military families commemorate their dead after perhaps 6 million in Indochina were killed in the JFK Johnson-Nixon wars before the USA was finally defeated by Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos. If Vietnam Veterans Day is a reminder of the tragedy of US imperialism, at least here in the heart of the Middle East, Ukraine peace negotiations aimed at averting thermonuclear war have been underway. It was today in 2004, encouraged by George W. Bush's war in Iraq, that Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia and Slovenia joined NATO. It was a precursor to the provocation that led to the NATO proxy war on Russia through Ukraine. Despite the protestations of the EU and UK, that war at least seems to be ending. But another war is deepening. Tomorrow, Palestinians who are still alive mark Land Day, when over 100 unarmed Arab demonstrators, half of them women, were killed or wounded by UK-US armed Israeli soldiers in 1976. The greatest proof of Israeli capture of Donald Trump is that he has restarted Joe Biden's war on Yemen, that he's targeting Iran, and that he's supporting genocide in Gaza. In just 51 minutes this week, hundreds of children were killed in just one atrocity. Miko Peled fought with IDF Special Forces and is a son of an Israeli general and a grandson of one of the signatories of the creation of Israel. You can find out more about his redemption from our interview with him for his book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. It's on Rumble. Today he fights tirelessly against genocide at the non-profit Palestine House of Freedom. He joins me from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Miko, for coming back on Going Underground. The press here, 50,000, a figure that's obviously much higher, in fact, from the genocide in Gaza. I suppose I better ask you just what you felt this week after that little pause of aerial bombardment, at least, of the genocide Joe regime. How again, the genocide has restarted.
I don't think there was, first of all, thanks for having me again. Good to be with you. I don't think there's any surprise that they continued. I mean, it was predictable, which also means it was preventable. We knew that the Israelis were going to go back in. It was part of their commitment going forward. It was part of the deal that they made among themselves to pass the so-called ceasefire, was that they were going to go back in and kill as quickly as they could. It is shocking because that little reprieve, I think, gave people kind of a sense of maybe hope. And then seeing this massive bombardment after that short reprieve, I think really hit people hard. But it was to be, like I said, it was to be expected. They said they were going to do it. They did it. As long as they exist, as long as Israel is permitted to continue to exist, it will continue to destroy and kill. And the genocide will not stop. So if people want to see it stop, then there has to be a more, you know, systemic solution rather than a ceasefire.
Yeah, but what helped Trump get elected were the Muslim voters of Michigan, and Trump did keep talking about peace. So people thought, look, he did get that aerial bombardment ceasefire. Does it mean that Miriam Adelson's role and other AIPAC contributor roles, they've captured the White House again? Because clearly they didn't support the initial ceasefire, and no one in the media over there in D.C. is even talking, they are in Western Europe, actually, talking about the fact that it's Israel that violated the agreement that Trump had brokered.
Well, the whole notion of a ceasefire with a genocidal regime is absurd. It's absolutely absurd. It's like having asked Hitler for a ceasefire during World War II. You don't ask for a ceasefire when there's a genocide. You have to end the genocide. A ceasefire gave a little bit of reprieve to the Palestinians. It gave a lot more reprieve and the ability to restock and so forth for the Israelis, and so they could come back even stronger. But a ceasefire is completely irrelevant. It's immaterial. It's the wrong approach and it's the wrong ask. There has to be an end to the genocide, and to end the genocide, you have to end the apartheid state. So if anyone is serious about ending the genocide of the Palestinian people, it's time to look at the apartheid state and dismantle it. Severe sanctions. Severe, complete arms embargo, no fly zone over Gaza. I mean, the demands have to be absolutely, you know, unconditional and as strong and worded in the strongest possible way. A ceasefire is not going to do it. A ceasefire was demanding and talking and asking for a ceasefire, I thought from the very beginning, was misleading and it was a wrong ask. Israel needs to be put, to completely stop. And there's no other way to do it other than dismantling the apartheid state altogether.
Well, there are no sign of any reduction in arms exports. In fact, some reports show that Britain is sending more reconnaissance warplane flights over Gaza than even Israel. You know, someone sent me this, 51 documents, Zionist collaboration with the Nazis. And, of course, European nations deny they're helping the Azov battalion, the Nazi insignia'd battalions of in eastern Ukraine. Tell me what you think is going through the heads of Western European leaders as they pour weaponry, if we just leave the United States to one side, pouring weaponry, Germany, France and Britain mainly, and Italy.
Again, I don't think there's any surprise here. I mean, why, you know, the Western European, you know, European powers, you know, always supported the killing of people of color. It was never an issue. And from the very beginning, they supported the apartheid state and the genocide of the Palestinian people going back all the way to the establishment of the apartheid state 3 years after the end of World War II. So I don't think there's any surprise here that they continue. Why would they stop? The killing of people of color has never been an issue with the Europeans. So
you really think it is? Because you know how they get criticized for woke ideology, these European leaders, for positive discrimination in their own countries of people of color. These leaders would all deny that. And at the same time, continually, obviously, visibly privilege Israeli Zionist deaths over
They can deny all they want. I mean, the proof is in their action. The proof is in the fact that the weapons are still being shipped to the apartheid state, and they're enabling, if not participating willingly, in the genocide of the Palestinian people. And the only difference is the Palestinian people are people of color, and nobody cares about them. And again, it goes historically, they never cared. So why would they care now? Historically, they allowed this to happen. 3 years after the end of the Holocaust, they allowed for the genocide of the Palestinian people to commence. You know, the 3 years after terms like, you know, crimes against humanity and you know, genocide, all these phrases were coined, all these crimes were, you know, were canonized, if you will. 3 years after that, they allowed the genocide of the Palestinian people to commence and an apartheid racist state to take hold in Palestine. It's because they're Palestinians. Nobody cares. If the Europeans cared, then they wouldn't have allowed this way back then, and they wouldn't have allowed it today. There's really no difference, I believe. And it's up to the constituents. If people of conscience, there are enough constituents that stand up and say, we do not want our government, we will not allow our governments to support this, then they will stop. But until people rise up and demand a stop, it's not going to happen.
You see, some might say that even though Trump resumed shipments of the mass slaughtering of baby bombs, as it were, he did get that aerial bombardment pause. And I've never heard any hostage envoy like Adam Bowler. Tell me what you think of Adam Bowler, who secretly did talk to Hamas and did that interview and to a shocked American public said that people in Hamas were human beings and was immediately obviously fired and actually said out aloud, the United States is not an agent of Israel, before he was fired. Can you not see that things have changed a little? I know you're saying it's all the same. You know, Trump has an Arab son-in-law, and we don't hear so much from that Zionist real estate son-in-law so much anymore.
Again, the proof is in the actions. I mean, yes, I thought the fact that they spoke to Palestinians in Gaza or whatever faction they choose to speak to is important. Finally, somebody's talking to the Palestinians about their destiny. But I don't know that the ceasefire was something that Palestinians need to be thankful for. I think the ceasefire
was... Okay, but come on, Miko. You never heard a U.S. Official say on television, I think on Israeli TV and on American TV, the United States is not an agent of Israel, when we know that, as far as the history goes, the United States has been a servant of Israel for so long.
So, like you said, he spoke, he said what he did, and then he was fired. So if they're still talking, that's good. The question is, what are they talking about? You know, and again, I don't think a ceasefire is something the Palestinians should be grateful for. I think the ceasefire was done to allow Israel to you know, to rearm, to collect itself. I mean, the party here, Israel was you know, completely paralyzed by the Palestinians in Gaza on October the 7th, and they still have not regained their full ability to function. the state of Israel is in a complete state of disarray. So I think the ceasefire was more to serve, as much as they pretended it was, they were the ones who were, you know, granting the ceasefire to the Palestinians. I think the ceasefire actually benefited Israel more than anybody else. And like I said earlier, of course, it's very nice to see Palestinians, receiving some food, getting some water, rebuilding a little bit, to give everybody a sense of optimism. But look what happened, you know, like I said, it was predictable and preventable. And here they are again. The massacres continue. The genocide continues as they said they were going to do. So I don't think there's any real progress here. The fact that one person spoke to representatives of this Palestinian faction or that Palestinian faction is immaterial. The question is, what do they talk about and what happens the next day? And the next day we see what is happening. The bombing is continued, the massacre, the slaughter of Palestinians continues, and Palestinians have no one to that protects them. They have no one to turn to. There's no one that is willing to step in and guarantee the safety and security of the Palestinian people. This is happening everywhere throughout all of Palestine. And so that is the issue. If that is not being discussed, if that's not on the agenda, then nothing else really matters.
I want to get on more to the self-destruction of Israel in part two, but do you think Trump is getting wrong information from Lieutenant Colonel Tulsi Gabbard and others, who's the Director of National Intelligence? Because clearly any plans they have, whether it be AIPAC plans, Adelson plan, Trump plans, the targeting of Yemen, simultaneous to targeting of Iran, will derail any strategic ideas that they have about beating the Palestinians or genociding the Palestinians, because the fight back has begun.
Well, I don't believe one second anyone's going to attack Iran. I don't think they've got what it takes, and I think they realize that that would be a strategically massive mistake. But attacking Yemen.
But it could be Netanyahu. On the Iran thing, it could be a Netanyahu unilateral attack against the wishes of Trump, of course, who would be advised that that would be.
I don't believe that's going to happen. I don't believe any of them are mad enough to put themselves in that position. But again, the attack on Yemen is punishing the Yemeni forces for their stance with Palestine and for the fact that the port of Eilat is all but bankrupt, that, you know, nothing is coming in. That's, you know, the Yemenite forces stood for Palestine. They did the one responsible thing, which is respond to the genocide. And they were very successful. Like I said, the port of Eilat is bankrupt. Not a single shipment of cars, nothing is coming in. And it's hurting the Israeli economy severely. And so they're being punished for that. This is what this is about. Yeah, again, Iran is a whole different avenue. It's a whole different thing here. I think the Americans and the Israelis know full well that a full-on attack on Iran is more than they can handle.
Miko Peled, I'll stop you there. More from the Palestine House of Freedom founder and grandson of a signatory to Israel's 1948 creation after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Miko Peled, Palestine House of Freedom founder and the grandson of a signatory to Israel's 1948 creation. Miko, of course, bizarre things happened in the SS and in Hitler's headquarters in World War II. We've repeatedly been hearing that Israel itself has been destabilized by events in the past year or so. How would you characterize it? I mean, the economy, all economic indicators show the economy has been destroyed. I mean, they're destroying their own education system in Israel, let alone anything else. And all around the world, people see Israel as a pariah country. And of course, it's destroyed any soft power it had with all the billions it must have spent on tourism and the like.
Well, I think it's important for people to take a moment here and remember that on October the 7th, we had fighters coming out of one of the poorest and most oppressed regions in the world, a place where a clean glass of water is a luxury. And they were able to completely paralyze the apartheid state. They're completely, you know, almost practically shut it down. The military, the intelligence, the police, the judicial system, the education system, and the medical and the entire healthcare system are all but bankrupt and dysfunctioning. The political discourse, both within society and among politicians, has reached level of madness that we've not seen before. People are at each other's throats in a way that, again, is a whole new level, even for even among Israeli politicians. And fear is everywhere. A sense of a complete lack of sense of security is prevalent. Like I said, the port of Eilat, which used to import 150 or 200,000 cars per year, is completely bankrupt thanks to the Yemeni forces. They have managed, what the Palestinians in Gaza have managed to do was incredible. And the state of Israel has not yet recovered, and I doubt that they will ever recover. And there are talks about, civil war and the protests against Netanyahu, for Netanyahu, or every single day there's a new big issue that everybody's ripping each other's throats about. So this is a blow that I do not believe Israel will ever recover from. And again, no one was ever able to do and cause such a blow to the apartheid state ever before. So this is where we are right now. I think it's important for people to take stock of that, to take a moment and reflect on what has happened. And of course, the willing of Palestinians to suffer this enormous, enormous genocide, these enormous punitive steps that were taken by Israel and the West because they dared to stand up. But this is really what this is about.
Yeah, we've talked to people who said it is the beginning of the end of the country that your grandfather signed, was a signatory to its creation. Just remind us what Shin Bet is and what on earth has been happening with the local security, secret security force, I suppose Britain's equivalent of MI5, US's equivalent of FBI, I'm not sure. What is the fight going on between Netanyahu and the secret services in Israel?
So the Shabak, or the Shin Bet, it's called the Shabak. It's the General Security Service. It's kind of the internal intelligence services. I think it's I'm not sure if I'd equate it with the FBI, but it's the internal security service that's mostly charged with the Palestinians, but also with some other some other elements within the settler and kind of a radical elements within Israeli society. And the blame game about there's two elements here. One is the blame game about October 7th. So the army's taken the blame. The chief of staff has resigned. A few other officers, resigned. And Shabak, who is also, they're charged with having assets, information assets, intelligence assets within the Palestinian society. Obviously, it was a massive failure. And so Netanyahu and the head of the Shabak is probably has the closest relationship to the prime minister because they are actually their boss is the prime minister. They're within the prime minister's office. And Netanyahu wants to fire him and he is resisting. And there's also another issue, which is that the Shabak has been investigating historically for a very long time, the Kahana elements, the kind of the right-wing Jewish terrorist groups. Now, the head of the Israeli National Security Ministry is a Kahanist. He's one who comes from that realm of Zionist terrorism. And so they've apparently been investigating that office as well and these elements within the government. And like I said earlier, the entire system is imploding. The entire system is just falling apart. So now you've got protests in the streets and whether or not the prime minister has the right or doesn't have the right to fire him. There's the issue with the attorney general also that the government wants to fire. And again, the whole judicial system is falling apart. So it's just one more element in this entire, I think a good way to equate Israeli society and the state of Israel is kind of like a bunch of different groups that were forced together with scotch tape. And now the scotch tape is falling apart. And this is, I think, largely as a result of October the 7th. The scotch tape is falling apart. This entire society is disintegrating. The state is disintegrating. And again, you've got the element of the judiciary falling apart. You've got the element of the intelligence services falling apart. The police is known to be corrupt and useless for a very long time. And on and on and on. And the military, of course, as well. So this is, again, one more element. And then right away, people are in the streets and people are disappointed or more than disappointed, I should say, about the fact that there's still hostages being held by the Palestinians in Gaza. The state has been dealt a blow that, I don't think they will ever recover from. And this ripping of the scotch tape and the disintegration of the state of Israel and Israeli society is something that we're seeing in front of our very eyes every single day.
I mean, clearly, Israel is the most dangerous place in the world to be a Jew. And I suppose since you mentioned October the 7th quite a few times, just remind us of the kind of society where, of course, soldiers were taken prisoner, but there were also people going to a rave on October the 7th. What sort of mentality is it that people might have to organize some kind of rave party beside, in effect, Auschwitz?
Well, I'll answer that with a little anecdote. So one of the Israeli settlements that was hit the hardest is a kibbutz by the name of Be'eri. It's been in the headlines quite a lot. And I had relatives there. And so growing up, we used to spend summers there and weekends there and holidays there because we had cousins there. It's a beautiful settlement in the Nakab region, not maybe 3 kilometers from Gaza Strip. And, you know, these settlements are beautiful. The Israelis who live in the Nakab enjoy a very high standard of living. And nobody ever talked about the fact that we are 3 kilometers away from basically a concentration camp. It was never brought up. It was never mentioned. It was not anything that anybody cared about. So there's a history of living really well and enjoying the abundance of Palestine and the resources of Palestine at the expense of Palestinians, while Palestinians are languishing in a concentration camp. It's a history that goes back all the way to the establishment of the apartheid state. So the fact that they could have this, you know, this music festival or whatever it was, you know, a few kilometers away, I mean, they don't even see Palestinians. It's not that they recognize or don't recognize, they don't even see Palestinians. And because of segregation, is so effective. The Zionists created the segregation system that is so incredibly effective. You can have 2 million people in a concentration camp a few kilometers away, and nobody cares because nobody sees them. And that's precisely what we saw. So when the Palestinians rose, suddenly the Israelis are, oh my God, how dare they? How can they? Well, when did anybody ever express even the slightest concern for the fact that 2 million people living 2 kilometers away or 3 kilometers away do not have access to clean water? That children who have an ear infection do not have access to antibiotics, to people who are being shot and killed by the Israeli forces do not have access to proper medical care. You know, nobody ever cared about that. Suddenly everybody's like, oh my God, how dare they? Well, where were you for the last 80 years? Where were you when these people are languishing in camps? Where were you when you're enjoying their land, their water, their resources, and denying them the resources? At least if they were sharing the resources, you'd say, fine, okay, there's plenty of resources to go around. But denying all these millions of people the resources, enjoying them, just again, within sight of this and completely ignoring it, I mean, what kind of expectation was there that this would not happen? I don't know what kind of virtual, insane world people exist in that they do not expect something like this to happen. And then they blame the Palestinians for it and condemn the Palestinians for it.
I mean, it's clear that the impact of that has led to all this trouble in Israel, as it were. And Netanyahu, the corrupt leader there, is desperate for it to continue before he perhaps ends up in prison. I know you said that you don't expect the war to be expanded as Netanyahu might wish to Iran. But surely a false flag with the right people around Trump, I mean, Mike Waltz, his national security advisor, certainly doesn't share any kind of same kind of ideas as, say, Tucker Carlson when it comes to war on Iran. A false flag could be arranged, couldn't it? And isn't that Netanyahu's only way out, to try and expand this war desperately, as arguably he has done helping Trump to his decision to bomb Yemen? Isn't Netanyahu's only way out is for the expansion to Iran?
This whole idea of war with Iran is...
Well, Miriam Adelson wants it.
I'm saying the war with Iran, or the discourse, the conversation of war with Iran, is very effective as a conversation piece, as a threat. No one wants this to actually happen, but they come back to it every time it's useful politically. Both, I mean, other prime ministers, even before Netanyahu, used it. They would say, oh, my God, look at Iran. There's going to be a war on Iran. We're going to have to attack Iran. Nobody's going to attack Iran. They don't want to attack Iran. They want to use the idea of attacking Iran as a political tool. And this is true both for the American administration and for whatever governments in power in the apartheid state in Israel. It doesn't matter. Attacking Iran would be a colossal mistake, both for the U.S. and for Israel. And then what are you going to do the next day? You're not going to have it as a tool anymore. The strength of the strength is in the idea. The strength is in the threat. The strength is using it as a political tool. If you use it, it's like you've thrown away the value of the idea of a war with Iran. Plus, it would be catastrophic. And I think everybody realized it would be catastrophic for both Israel and for the United States. So it's a good tool. They climb up that tree, they declare a war in Iran, and then they come off the tree, come down from the tree, and they move on to something else. And I suspect that's going to be the case, you know, moving forward. No one's going to attack Iran, not seriously.
You know, journalists, real journalists, celebrated Trump's victory because, of course, he talked about the First Amendment. There was that great J.D. Vance lecturing of the Europeans about what freedom of speech means. Free speech, obviously, is being the principles of it being violated in your country right now, in the United States, over Israel. What was your reaction to the brutal beating of the co-director of the Oscar-winning No Other Land? And how has it been covered in the United States that, I don't know whether the Oscar saved his life, he's been released, Hamdan Bilal. What does it tell you, the coverage of what happened to him? I don't know whether, if it had been a Jewish Oscar winner, how the coverage would have been versus it being an Arab.
Well, actually, there's been a great deal of coverage, you know, in the mainstream media, all over the place. There's been a lot of outrage. And the ridiculous thing is that there is outrage. What did they expect? The Palestinians have no protection. So, of course, of course settlers are going to come and punish them to say, you know, to give the middle finger to the rest of the world, say, you think you can give them an Oscar and that'll save them? We're masters of the land here. We are going to determine what happens to these Arabs, not you. We don't care how many awards you give them. They're still our slaves, and if we want to kill them and beat them up, we will. I'm surprised they didn't kill them, but maybe they just didn't feel like it at the moment. But the hypocrisy is in the outrage, because Palestinians are not protected. No one is protecting. They have no recourse. There's nobody that cares. Nobody gives a damn about the safety and security of Palestinians. So this was to be expected. There should have been protection. There should be protection so that Palestinians are not as vulnerable as they are. But if they're allowing the genocide to commence in Palestine, what is it for? Well, you know, why would they care about a particular Palestinian in some tiny little poor village in the West Bank? Who cares? You know what I mean? This is all part of the exact same problem. Nobody wants to step in and guarantee the safety and security of the Palestinian people, a people who have been subjected to genocide and a reign of terror for almost 8 decades. There needs to be a decision, either stop complaining and stop, you know, expressing this ridiculous outrage, or do something to protect these people, protect the Palestinian people.
Miko Peled, thank you.
Sure, anytime. Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our condolences to the bereaved in this region because of Donald Trump's restarting of Joe Biden's genocide. We'll be back on Monday to follow the money with a former financial advisor to the UAE government. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.